From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about breast cancer with a surgeon who has a unique perspective on the disease. Dr. Ursula Zyniga organized a support group for breast cancer patients, but they sometimes felt she didn't understand what they were going through. Then 2.5 years ago, Dr. Zyniga got breast cancer herself and went through treatment for the disease. She'll tell us what it was like to be a doctor and patient at the same time. Also, a talk with science writer James Glick. He wrote the bestseller Chaos, which explained the scientific theory to a lay audience. His new book is a biography of the late physicist Richard Feynman. And book critic John Leonard pays tribute to the unappreciated work of the literary translator. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bill Clinton spent time with state lawmakers today in Little Rock, easing the way for the lieutenant governor's transition. Clinton's been tight-lipped about his own transition, but he aims to convene a meeting of business and economic leaders sometime before Christmas. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The normally talkative governor has spoken only briefly with reporters since he won the White House. He declines to comment on anything of substance and says of the transition only that he will not rush into any decisions. But according to his campaign and transition team advisors, he plans to call business and economic leaders to Little Rock sometime next month to reach consensus on short and long-term economic goals. Economic Post will be the first announced sometime next month. Treasury Secretary, Office of Management and Budget Director, and the newly created position of National Economic Advisor. Mr. Clinton has spoken by telephone to several world leaders, and spokesman George Stephanopoulos said today he will continue to take congratulatory calls. He insists that the substance of such talks is minimal, and that Mr. Clinton uses the time to emphasize that there is only one president, and for now, that's President George Bush. I'm Elizabeth Arnold, reporting.
Red Cross officials in Sarajevo say they plan to begin evacuating about 6,000 civilians from the besieged capital city tomorrow. The evacuation was planned for last week, but it was blocked by Bosnian military officials who suspected that men of military age were trying to leave the city. Red Cross coordinator Pava Barisic said that buses will take some refugees to the port of Split on the Adriatic coast and some to Belgrade in Serbia. Barisic said it was hoped that the UN Protection Force would provide an escort for the refugee convoys. The Reuters news agency quoted a senior UN official as saying that the Protection Force would not provide an escort unless it was requested by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Three British businessmen were acquitted today of selling arms to Iraq illegally. The trial came to a dramatic end when British government officials admitted they'd promoted the sales, and the prosecution attorney acknowledged he no longer had a case. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The three executives of the Matrix Churchill Company are free tonight after the government's case fell apart. They were accused of breaking British export law, but in 3 weeks of testimony, government officials said the exports had been secretly approved in exchange for intelligence about Iraq's nuclear program. The trial was controversial as well as embarrassing for the British government. The charges brought by the Customs Service ended up pitting one government agency against others and showed that ministers kept the information from Parliament. The Matrix Churchill Company has an office in Ohio, and the trial raised questions about the amount of information on Iraq's weapons program that was shared with the Central Intelligence Agency. In London, this is Deborah Amos.
The Dow Industrials gained less than a point today. This is NPR News. Police in Germany say that almost 200,000 people staged rallies across the country today to protest new right-wing violence on the anniversary of the 1938 Nazi Kristallnacht attack on Jews. The police said that peaceful demonstrations were held in Cologne, Munich, and seven other cities. Seven Detroit police officers are awaiting results of an internal investigation to see if they'll face criminal charges in the beating death of a black man after a traffic stop last week. Don Gagne reports.
The Wayne County Prosecutor's Office says warrants could be issued sometime tomorrow against officers who were present when 35-year-old Malice Green was beaten to death on a Detroit street late Thursday night. Green was driving through a Detroit neighborhood when he was stopped by an unmarked police car. Why officers began to strike him with their flashlights is not clear. Eventually, five backup officers arrived on the scene. All but one was white. The Detroit News in today's edition quotes the emergency medical technicians who witnessed the incident as saying four of the police officers participated in Green's beating. They say at least one officer repeatedly pummeled the victim in the face. Sources told the paper that even those officers who did not actively join in the attack could still face charges. Family members of the victim have called upon people to remain calm and let the criminal justice system do its work. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A top Federal Reserve official called on Congress today to approve the money needed to complete the savings and loan bailout. Robert Perry, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, said that healthy thrift institutions are being hurt by the delay in dealing with problem SNLs. The Resolution Trust Corporation, the entity set up to handle the thrift bailout, ran out of money earlier this year, and Congress refused to appropriate more. Perry said the new Congress should make it a high priority to provide the $42 billion needed to complete the thrift bailout. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The statistics for breast cancer are enough to make you sick. It's estimated that 1 in 9 American women get the disease. My guest, Dr. Ursula Zeiniger, is a surgeon who specializes in breast disease. She has an understanding of breast cancer that most doctors don't. She developed breast cancer 2.5 years ago. The first sign was a slight thickening of the tissue she discovered during a self-exam. The mammogram revealed nothing unusual. Other doctors felt no abnormality. But Dr. Zeiniger knew something was wrong. A laboratory test revealed the cells were cancerous. Then she became the patient. She underwent surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. All of her subsequent tests for cancer have been negative. Dr. Zeiniger is affiliated with Graduate Hospital in Philadelphia. We invited her to tell us what she learned about illness and health care from her own experience. I asked her what it was like when she found out she had cancer.
I learned it in a very, probably in one of the less pleasant ways, although I don't think there's a good way, but I had just gotten back from a very lovely trip to meet my parents for my father's 81st birthday. And the day after my return, I said to my partner, look, do the fine needle aspiration. I just want to have it out of my system. I want to know what's going on. And we had a staff meeting that afternoon, and no results were called up from pathology. And on the way home with my husband, being like all happy and relaxed, leaving work, and my husband and I work together, I said, well, let's stop by in pathology and look at these slides of mine. I almost forgot about it. And then I walk into the pathologist's office, and she looked a little perturbed, and then I said, what is it? And she says, well, it's positive. And I said, well, let me look at the slides. There was like no transition. There was no one coming towards you, maybe with a serious face or someone maybe giving an indication. It was cold, flat out. And I just looked at my slides and I said, under the microscope, and I said, yes, it's positive. My husband and I walked out of there. I don't think we said anything for 10 minutes. It was this total shock as to what had happened, because we were so unprepared and emotionally so happy going out. We had invited friends for dinner that evening. We never thought it would be positive.
When you found out that you had breast cancer, what was the first decision you had to make?
The first decision my husband and I really had to make, how we were going to handle it, who was going to be my surgeon. And I had, we talked about it on the way home, and I thought I would contact a surgeon I had seen a few times who was my former chief when I was in training. And then my husband said, listen, would you mind very much, or would you like me to be your surgeon? And my first reaction was, that is terrific. And my second reaction was, this is going to be incredibly hard to do it so there is no indelible mutual obligation. I felt that, yes, it would be terrific because it would give both of us control. It would also give both of us a sharing in this very, very isolating experience, which is having cancer, having any major illness. But I also realized it must be very difficult for him. So I said, okay, as long as we really pledge that if you find it too tough or if I find it too tough, we change.
How did it work out?
Terrific. Was very difficult at times, but I don't think it was anywhere near as difficult as it would have been if I had had someone else operate on me. And then the person who is so close to you, as your husband, would then be an outsider in the events. And it really gave both of us total control over the planning, the decision-making, the choice of treatment, you know, deciding between lumpectomy, axillary dissection, and radiation therapy versus mastectomy.
Now, how did you make the decision to have a lumpectomy versus mastectomy? And I'll say here that a friend of mine has anguished over that decision for her own self. And it's just been a torturous decision for her.
I went, what I always tell my patient to do, I went by real gut feeling. We all know that barring some very special circumstances, the cure rates are the same. So that it's not a question that you're going to do something frivolous for the sake of beauty or integrity or wholeness of your body, jeopardizing cancer treatment. The cure rates are the same whether you go with a mastectomy or you go with lumpectomy, axillary dissection, and radiation therapy. So what you really have to decide is how comfortable you are going to be either without your breast being able to say, okay, it's out of me, it's away from me, it's taken off, nothing can ever happen there again, or saying how comfortable are you going to be with a breast that has some scars on it, that may have some deformity, that has been radiated, but knowing that you still, for all intents and purposes, have maintained your physical integrity. And I took one look at myself and I said, I want to keep it. And basically went from there. Now, it meant the initial biopsy, and then there were some tumor cells very close to the edge of that excision. And in order to have satisfactory control of cancer when you go for lumpectomy and radiation therapy, you have to have clean rims of normal tissue around the tumor. So I went for a second excision and then sat there and literally with the pathologist looked at some 60 slides to determine that all the borders were clean, and then said, okay. That morning, basically, at 8 o'clock that morning, I sat with the pathologist and looked at my slides, and I was set that day to go either for lumpectomy or mastectomy, depending on what the results of that second excision would be. And they were okay, so I went for my axillary dissection.
You're just joining us. My guest is Dr. Ursula Zeiniger, and she's a surgeon specializing in breast disease. And she had breast cancer about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, and that has been cured. Is that the right word?
Well, I really don't think that is the appropriate word. Unfortunately, with breast cancer, like with most cancers, we really know that it can come back a long time out, and it's a false hope to speak of cure. Certainly at this point, it isn't. I can say that 2.5 years later, I feel more confident, more comfortable. I'm less anxious about it. But I think saying that you're cured at this point would be very premature.
You kept up your practice while you were getting chemotherapy.
Yes.
What was it like for you to operate on, I don't know if it was a full schedule or a reduced schedule, but you were sick with the disease that you were treating patients for. Did you want them to know?
The patients knew because I had to let them know. I was basically getting treatment at times with my patients following me or preceding me in radiation therapy, or we would cross paths when we went to chemotherapy. I've had a breast cancer support group that meets once a month. So obviously anybody who came to that group, which is a good 20-30% of the patients, knew that I was in the hospital or that I was having treatment because I did take about 3 or 4 weeks off. So they knew, and it made for a very close and very difficult experience in treating them.
What helped bring you closer, and what made it difficult?
Well, what made it closer was that they were just so incredibly kind and always asking how I was and always having this true sense of caring for how I felt. Almost, I felt at times they cared more about me than maybe I ever showed that I cared for them. It was a real office hours turned into, but how are you? How is it going for you? Are you okay? What can we do to help? That sort of thing. What made it difficult was that at the end of office hours, I would usually be totally besides myself with emotional fatigue because I couldn't get away from my own disease. I couldn't distance myself because when I took care of them, they would turn chairs on me. and would ask me how I was. So hour after hour during office hours, we would be talking about them and a great deal about me and my fears and how I felt. It took me about 6 months to get back to just saying, listen, I'm just fine. Thank you very much for asking. I think if I hadn't found that ability to say that, whether it was true or not, you know how it is, someone says, how are you? You say, I'm fine. You may feel dreadful, but it's sort of a social convention to establish a little bit of distance and privacy. And if I hadn't learned that, I don't think I could have continued to take care of them.
Was there a specific moment where you realized you had to learn where to draw the line?
There's a very difficult time after the end of treatment when all the treatments are over. Like, initially, it's hard to deal with the impact of the diagnosis, but something happens every day. You have to make decisions. You're sort of in the thick of it. You're constantly surrounded by people who are saying, we're treating you, we're going to cure you, we're going to do something positive. And then all of a sudden, after 6 months, your treatments are over. And you have this incredible feeling of who's rooting in my corner, who's doing anything for me. Now it's you against the cancer, and it's sheer hell. I found it sheer hell for about 4 weeks. And during that time, unfortunately, three of my patients, one got lung metastasis, two got bone metastasis. So when I just said, well, you know, I think I'm going to be okay, I had to confront some of my patients doing a lot worse than I was and saying, well, here, but for the grace of God. So it took about 6 weeks during which I ended up getting a bone scan myself because I couldn't deal with it anymore and was sort of coming through this whole emotional struggle to say, well, if my bone scan is positive, what am I going to do? You know, I didn't want to be as unprepared as I was for my fine needle aspiration 6 months prior. So I said, my husband said, well, let's get a bone scan. You know, I go with you, we'll organize it, you get a bone scan, it's going to make you feel better. And I said, yes, but what if it's positive? How am I going to deal with it? I am not going to be able to deal with it, this vulnerability once again. So I somehow decided at that point I had to just see my patients. They are my patients. I care for them very much. But I can't have it reflect back on me all the time because I couldn't be functioning effectively. It's not fair to them. Wouldn't be fair to me.
Do you not tell patients anymore?
I now tell them in a much more, I control when I tell them, and I very often tell them when they look at me and they say, but how can I possibly function? How can I possibly deal with chemotherapy or something like that? But it's going to be so hard. I say, look, I went through 2 years ago. It's very, very hard. It can be done. I know you can do it. But it's not, it's a more controlled and constructive way, I think, of letting them know.
You know, I can think of all the times I've gone to a doctor feeling really ill and really worried about what this meant. And really envying the doctor, thinking, well, God, the doctor's really got it easy. They're just running around treating people, but they're feeling good today. You know, and this is what you kind of come to expect from doctors. And I wonder what, if you have any sense of what it was like for your patients, thinking that their doctor wasn't immune from the problem they were having. Of course, no doctor is, but you just, you know, when you're lying there in this incredibly vulnerable position on the table, it's the kind of thing you think.
There's one patient who I had seen who had no breast cancer, never had any, but she had a strong family history and she was very much afraid of developing breast cancer. So she literally came every 3 months at her own request for a breast exam. She stopped coming. And I know that for some of the other patients, there was a real concern that I might sort of go die on them. One of them expressed it in a book. She's an author. And others expressed it to a therapist who was working with them in a therapy group session. I think it is scary because it's true. I think you expect your physicians to be invulnerable in many ways. But I think once you go beyond that, it actually gives a certain amount of confidence to say that at least there's one person who knows what it was like and can more than sympathize, really share in some of the feelings.
My guest is Dr. Ursula Zeiniger, a surgeon who specializes in breast cancer. She recently had breast cancer. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Ursula Zeiniger, and she's a surgeon who specializes in breast cancer. Now, let's get back to when you were the only person who thought that there was something wrong with your breast. You did a self-exam. You found something. All of your colleagues thought that things looked fine. Did this change your feelings at all about self-exams, about doing them more often, not just for yourself but for patients? Did it change your feelings about the advice you should be giving patients?
I have very mixed feelings about self-exam. I think the whole thrust in dealing with breast cancer has been early diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, early diagnosis is really mammography. Self-exam picks up lesions or tumors that are at least 1 centimeter or 1/2 inch. Probably most of the time they're being picked up when they're about 2 centimeters. Mammogram picks up lesions that are much smaller. Very often so small that they're either only apparent as a 1/8 of an inch or a 1/16 of an inch little shadow, or at times they're too small to be felt. The thrust or the incredible pressure to perform breast self-examination, I think, is probably exaggerated because it really picks up tumors relatively late.
You know, a lot of women are very confused when they do self-exams because they have kind of lumpy breasts anyways. And you can't tell what's a kind of normal lump for you and what's a lump that is out of the ordinary and requires a biopsy. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why a lot of women aren't as conscientious as they're told to be about their exams.
I think that's true. I think it's probably not well taught. You see, you're being taught when you teach breast self-exam, you're taught to feel something and then sort of make a decision what you're feeling. It takes a tremendous amount of experience to actually examine a breast, multiple, many, many breasts, not just your own, at different times in your life, and to say, this feels like tumor A, tumor B, this is obviously a cancer or whatever. And when we teach women to do breast self-exam, there's always this feeling, well, you feel for a lump. What you really should do if you examine yourself, and a lot of the time it's just a natural touching yourself, whether it be in the shower or getting dressed or looking at yourself without making a big thing out of a structured exam, what you really should be aware of is anything that is different.
Do you think that's why you were able to spot something irregular in your breasts and your husband, who's a surgeon, and the other doctors you went to thought that there was nothing unusual?
I think because, yes, as
you were really familiar.
Woman, you're really familiar with it. There's something else also that if you examine yourself, you get a sense of the perception of your finger pushing your breast tissue against the muscles on your chest wall. So you actually have a second dimension to your sensation, which is what it feels like when it hits your chest wall. So I felt there was something that was just, it was very subtle, but it was sort of just a little denser to me, maybe just a little more irregular, some tenacity or change in consistency that I was not aware of before.
Now, when you detected something was wrong with your breast, nothing showed up on the mammogram.
That's right? True.
Now, why didn't anything show up on the mammogram? And has this changed your feelings one way or another about the annual mammograms that are usually recommended for women over 40?
Okay, you have to be very careful that you distinguish between two uses of mammography. Mammography as a screening modality. Screening means early detection of a cancer in an otherwise totally asymptomatic population. My situation was very different. I felt something and I went for the mammogram sort of as a saying, well, maybe that would help identify something. But just because the mammogram was negative and didn't show anything in that area or anywhere else for that matter, did not make me abandon the fact that I felt something. A mammogram, if you feel a lump and the mammogram doesn't show that lump, the only thing the mammogram can say is, I don't see that lump, but that doesn't mean the lump isn't there.
So the mammogram doesn't see everything.
The mammogram does not see everything, and when there is a palpable lump or any other abnormality, then someone, regardless of what the mammogram shows, has to get a tissue confirmation of what that is, whether it's putting a little needle in, doing a biopsy, any of a number of techniques. But you cannot ignore a patient complaint or a physical finding.
So what you would say to people listening now is that they should get their screening mammograms, but that doesn't mean that everything's necessarily okay and they should still do their breast exams.
If you have a screening mammogram and a negative exam, let's say in October,
mm-hmm.
and in January you feel a breast lump, then that breast lump needs to be followed up
right.
with every bit the same concern and accuracy as you would do it if you didn't have the mammogram.
Are there things that surprised you while you were getting your treatment about how you were treated at hospitals or what doctors didn't seem to understand or what the technicians didn't seem to quite get about the experience of getting radiation or chemo or whatever?
Most people, certainly anybody to do with surgery and anybody to do with radiation therapy was remarkably tuned into the fact that the patient, or myself for that matter, was undergoing something fairly invasive. I mean, radiation therapy, when you're lying under that machine the first few times, I was truly scared out of my brain. I mean, you are so indoctrinated to be afraid of radiation, and all of a sudden you're lying there and you're getting mega doses thrown at you. I was counting the seconds as if it doesn't shut off in 13 seconds. I'm going to jump. And everybody was very much aware of it and told me not to be afraid. They would be watching all the time. It was very reassuring. I found chemotherapy much different. It was much less concern by the people giving it, the nurses and the staff giving it, over the fear of having actual, what you would consider, poisons running into your body. It made it very hard. The rooms are not set up in a fashion that is very conducive for the patient to be comfortable. The smell of the drug actually is to the point that it can still make me nauseated if I think about it hard enough. I think there's a lot that could be done to improve the setting, distract patients from unpleasant smells that you might associate with chemotherapy, reducing the sense of anticipatory nausea as you're going into the room, things like that. And then some people were just, I guess, not giving much thought to the patient.
Do you ever wish that you could change careers and stop treating breast cancer so that you could get further away from what you had yourself?
I could have done without breast cancer altogether. But I think ultimately it has made me much better equipped in dealing with my patients. And now that I have learned again to feel myself, there is a sense, I think, when you have cancer that you have to reconstitute your own being as being whole again. You feel incredibly invaded when it happens, just by the disease. Forget about the treatment, just by the fact that you have a cancer. Now that I feel that I've made myself whole again, I actually enjoy taking care of the patients because I can give them something I could have given them otherwise. So I don't think I would give that up.
Dr. Zeiniger, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Ursula Zeiniger is a surgeon affiliated with Graduate Hospital in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Coming up, more chaos. We talk with James Glick, author of the best-selling book on the scientific theory of chaos. His new book is a biography of the physicist Richard Feynman. And John Leonard reflects on the importance of literary translators. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. As 11 newly elected senators met in Washington to learn more about their new jobs, new members of the House met the House Democratic leadership in Chicago. The faster-than-usual orientation is an effort to have them up and running by the time President-elect Clinton takes office. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
The whole point of the road tour of House Speaker Tom Foley, Democratic Majority Leader Richard Gephardt, and Ways and Means Chairman Dan Rostenkowski is to get this bunch of new congressmen ready to be in Congress by the time President-elect Bill Clinton takes office. There are committees to be organized, seats to be selected, matters that usually take Congress into mid-February. But, said Speaker Foley, the leadership and the President-elect want a fast start. Foley met with 20 new congressmen today from northern states.
I've met almost all of them before. I have, frankly, never seen a more able and experienced group of incoming members of Congress in my 28 years.
Because of their number, the new group could also exercise some independence. Tomorrow, the Democratic leadership meets with more new members in Atlanta. I'm Jackie Lydon in Chicago.
President-elect Bill Clinton says that he wants to hold a summit meeting of some of the brightest people in the nation to talk about the nation's economic problems and how to solve them. Clinton says that there are a lot of very troubling signs in the economy, and that is what the recent election was all about. Clinton said that he would like a 2 or 3 day summit of business leaders and economists before he is sworn into office, in order for him to get as many good ideas as he can. Arab-Israeli peace talks resumed in Washington today after a break for the recent U.S. presidential election. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Israeli and Jordanian negotiators made progress late last month despite uncertainty about the future leadership of the United States, which is the key sponsor of the negotiations. Now that Bill Clinton has been elected, the question is, will the negotiations make progress despite the uncertainty of the presidential transition? Bill Clinton, in a phone conversation with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin today, reiterated his hope that there would be no slowdown in the talks. But violence in the region has flared again. Over the weekend, Hezbollah forces launched scores of rockets from Lebanon into northern Israel, prompting Israeli delegates to issue a stern warning to their Lebanese counterparts in the peace talks. According to Reuters, the chief Israeli delegate warned the Lebanese people they would not be able to live normally if the attacks against Israel continued. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than 1 point to close at 3,240.87 on volume of more than 198 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 9-8 in active trading. This is NPR News. Russian leader Boris Yeltsin is calling on Western business leaders to invest in his country. Yeltsin, now on a 2-day state visit to Britain, says that business relations between Russia and Western nations appear to be locked in the past. He says that he is planning a series of steps to attract Western investment, including lower taxes on profits and more opportunity to send profits home. Yeltsin also called for British help in rescheduling a $70 billion debt left by the Soviet government when it collapsed last year. The U.S. government was supposed to issue new regulations for food labels today, but a disagreement between the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Agriculture has delayed that announcement. Laura Kanoy reports.
A 1990 law gave the FDA until today to come up with new food label regulations. The law only covers the FDA, which regulates all processed foods except meat. But the Department of Agriculture, in charge of meat and poultry, had said its regulations would be consistent to avoid confusion. Now a dispute has erupted over fat. FDA wants labels to show fat content as a percentage of a healthy diet. USDA does not. Ohio Democratic Senator Howard Metzenbaum.
The culprit or the problem at this moment is the American Meat Institute. They don't want to tell the people how much fat is contained in their meat intake in each serving.
With no agreement, the impasse over food labels could continue well into the Clinton administration. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy in Washington.
British Prime Minister John Major and Russian President Boris Yeltsin have signed a new friendship treaty. After more than 4 hours of talks in London, Major announced that it was the first general treaty to be signed between Britain and Russia in more than 200 years. The two men also signed agreements on arms control and security. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For those of us who feel our lives are often in chaos, the scientific theory of chaos offers some interesting analogies. The best-selling book, Chaos, was written by my guest, James Glick. He's a science writer who used to be with the New York Times. He left the paper to write books. His new book, Genius, is a biography of the late physicist Richard Feynman. Glick describes Feynman as the most brilliant, iconoclastic, and influential physicist of modern times, the architect of quantum theories, the brash young group leader on the atomic bomb project, inventor of the Feynman diagram, and an ebullient bongo player and storyteller. Within the community of physicists, his name took on a special luster. It was permitted in connection with Feynman to use the word genius. Here's one of the reasons why.
There was a tremendous crisis just after the war in this new business of quantum mechanics. It seemed to work. It was very mysterious, as everyone knows. It gave sort of rough answers that looked right, but when physicists tried to calculate things more precisely, they discovered that the answers just went wild. They got infinity where they were supposed to be getting a real number. And this, of course, was on the heels of their great public triumph in creating the atomic bomb, which proved for the first time that physics really wasn't just something esoteric. It was something that could change all of our lives. So here they had this obscure crisis, and Feynman, a very young man, solved it at the same time as two other great physicists, Julian Schwinger, another American, and Sinitaro Tominaga, a Japanese. They all solved this problem independently. Schwinger and Tominaga solved it in a sort of traditional way, in a way that was instantly recognized, even though it was very difficult to use. Feynman solved it in a completely different way, in a way that was very visual. It relied on these sort of stick figure diagrams for particle interactions that are now called Feynman diagrams, and they're absolutely everywhere in physics. And at first, he had a terrible time getting this across. It wasn't rigorous mathematically. It was so different. J. Robert Oppenheimer, who had known Feynman from their work together on the atomic bomb and was now a sort of leader of the physics community, at first didn't trust Feynman's solution at all. He really had to be persuaded. There was a very weird couple of years when Feynman was almost in despair. And yet now it is Feynman's methods that are universally used, and they've turned out to have application not just to this problem, but to the very newest areas of physics and cosmology too.
Let's talk a little bit about Feynman's work with the creation of the atom bomb. He worked on the Los Alamos project when he was in his 20s. He headed the theoretical division of the atom bomb project. What were some of his specific contributions?
He was a group leader within the theoretical division. He was very young, and even to be a group leader was a remarkable amount of responsibility for someone just out of graduate school to be given on this project. He, interestingly, downplayed his own role afterwards. When he talked about Los Alamos, he always talked about cracking safes and tormenting the censors and playing tricks on the military authorities there. At one point, he sort of led a rebellion of the bachelors in one of the men's dormitories about the patrols of MPs. He presented himself as a cut-up. All of which was partly true, but wasn't, I don't think, the essence of his role there. And the fact is that Oppenheimer said at the time, that he had realized that Feynman was the most brilliant of the young physicists working on the project.
I know for some of the physicists who worked on the creation of the atom bomb, the real meaning of the bomb changed for them after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What was the psychological impact of the actual use of the bombs?
We forget
on him.
We forget now what the mood was. I mean, it's so easy for us to think, as so many people have said to me, how could a guy, a likable guy, a guy you admire, have done this terrible thing? How could anybody have worked on this project in the first place? In a way, the first thing you have to do to answer that question is to understand the psychology that existed before the bomb was dropped, when they were working on the project. Almost everyone, and it was certainly true of Feynman, did it enthusiastically. They were patriotic. They wanted to serve their country. They wanted to create this weapon. There weren't doubts. Oppenheimer, of course, always said that at the moment of the Trinity test, he had said, he had remembered this line from the Bhagavad Gita, "Now we are become death, destroyer of worlds." And that kind of guilt permeated people's memories and later accounts. But I think the first thing we have to remember is that guilt wasn't there for almost any of them at the time, and it wasn't there for Feynman. They were thrilled when that bomb went off successfully at Trinity, and they were also thrilled when the first news started coming back from Hiroshima. They actually celebrated the dropping of that bomb. It's shocking, but I don't think we can understand the mentality of the time unless we recognize it. Afterward, things changed for a lot of them, and certainly for Feynman, and the guilt did begin to sink in. They realized that the Germans hadn't been working on the bomb, and they realized also that they had known that before their work was finished. In a way, the best thing I heard on this subject was something Freeman Dyson said. It was that it wasn't just that they had created this thing that made the scientists feel so guilty. It was that they had so much fun doing it.
Was that borne out by what you read of Feynman's work?
Yeah, it's true. Feynman, like so many people there, always thought back to Los Alamos as one of the great experiences of his life. It was a wonderful place. They were isolated. They were fenced in. It was a community and a very international community. Brilliant people from all over the world, thrown together with this fantastic sense of purpose. People who were used to just writing stuff on blackboards suddenly had to apply all of their skills toward a goal. There was tremendous satisfaction in it. Now, afterward, Feynman, like some of the others, felt guilty. Feynman was absolutely in despair in the years after the war, although it didn't show outwardly. And he confided in some of his intimate friends that he would go around the country, and he would see people building bridges or building houses and think, they're crazy. They don't know what's coming, that there is going to be a nuclear war. Why are they bothering to build things when everything's just going to be destroyed?
My guest is science writer James Glick. His new book is a biography of the physicist Richard Feynman. The book is called Genius. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Science writer James Glick is my guest. He wrote the bestseller Chaos. His new book, Genius, is a biography of the physicist Richard Feynman. Now, I want to ask you a couple of things about chaos. I still find it hard to understand that there's actually a system to describe chaos. It seems like such a contradiction in terms.
Well, it does, and that's why it took so long for people to discover this new kind of science. So much of the science that we're taught in school, and this is still true, it was certainly true in Feynman's era, the practical science, has to do with things that are linear, things that can be described in terms of the equations that one can calculate. And those tend to be linear equations, nonlinear equations, where things shift uneasily as one element of the equation changes are much more difficult. So the physics that we tend to be brought up with describes, perforce, a fairly orderly world. I mean, after all, science began with an orderly world. It began with people discovering regularities in the middle of what was mostly incomprehensible. You know, the sun rising and falling on a recognizable schedule, the motions of the planets, and most of that stuff did create a very powerful science, but mostly applicable to orderly things. It was only in the 60s and 70s especially that people started to discover that some of the rest of the territory, discontinuities, erratic behavior, turbulence in fluids, the arrhythmic writhing of the human heart in fibrillation, erratic behavior of lasers, the unpredictable behavior of the Earth's weather, all of these phenomena that seem to be past the edge, uncomputable and separate, actually could be described, not predicted in a simple sense, but described with this remarkable new theory that luckily or unluckily got the name of chaos.
I wonder if you think part of the reason why people became so involved in this theory of chaos, and I'll mention your book was a bestseller, is because it just the word alone describes what we feel. You know, and I'm thinking, for instance, like when I learned about entropy, the kind of physical, the physics principle that things evolve toward disorder, I thought, great, my life, you know, my life, my house, my office, just everything around me. And I just really embraced entropy for a while. I thought, you know, this is a kind of a principle that just describes the way the world seems to me.
Right.
Do you think that has something to do with the interest in chaos?
We certainly do look to science for lessons about things that we just understand. And there are lessons from chaos, I think, that are very appealing to all of us. And another,
like what?
One of the first things that you hear about when you learn about chaos is the butterfly effect, the notion that in the Earth's weather, the flapping of a butterfly's wings today in New York can cascade upward through the atmosphere so rapidly that it can affect the course of huge storm systems 4 weeks from now on the other side of the globe. That's an extraordinary thing and quite counterintuitive, quite a surprise to professional meteorologists. And it's the heart of why, with the enormous increase in computing power, we still can't make good weather forecasts any farther into the future than 4 or 5 days. Well, we know from our own lives that small causes can have enormous consequences. You leave the house 10 seconds late and a flower pot hits your head, or more seriously, you miss a bus and you're 10 minutes late, and then the bus misses the train and you're an hour late. We know that I mean, it's the for want of a nail, the kingdom was lost syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So why should it have been such a surprise to scientists? Well, so much of science was based on the opposite being true, that if you can approximate things pretty well at the beginning of a chain of calculation, when you get to the end of the chain of calculation, you'll still have an answer that is approximately right. I mean, that's what lets you send a spaceship to Neptune and have some confidence that it's going to end up pretty much where you calculated it was going to be. Sure, there are going to be small uncertainties at the beginning, but they won't blow up. It turns out that in a lot of systems, a lot of chaotic systems, they do blow up. In fact, that's what defines a chaotic system. So in a way, science has had to catch up with something that we know from our own lives just by common sense.
Is there anything that you have learned in your years of science writing that has become a kind of guiding metaphor for your life, some physical principle that has become a metaphor for you?
In a way, I think I've learned that we have to be careful about drawing too many lessons from science. We look to science for metaphors. You know, we talked a little bit about entropy and the second law of thermodynamics, and chaos is another one. And it's proper to do that, but we also have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most important lesson from science is the lesson that Feynman emphasized throughout his whole life, and that is a kind of skeptical mentality. The essence of being a scientist is to be skeptical, not to believe things, but to disbelieve them. If you're really an honest scientist, as Feynman always was, you have to look at your theory and not think, why is this likely to be right? You have to look at it and think, what are all of the ways I could be fooling myself? How could this go wrong? Feynman was loved by experimentalists because he would come in and he would listen to the way they had done a calculation. You know, a calculation might have involved making a series of approximations, and at some point you have to stop. And Feynman would say, why did you stop there? Did you stop because that was the answer that you were expecting to get, or did you make up a plan before you did the calculations that forced you to stop at a certain point? He would keep people honest. And I think that that skeptical attitude helped him not just be a great scientist, but have the right understanding of things like UFOs and parapsychology. And Feynman always actually had a lot of fun poking holes in this sort of thing, going after people who claimed to be able to bend spoons and really explaining what was wrong with it in a way that I think all of us can understand. You would think that in this era when we can turn on the television and see images beamed from outer space, we can see what the Earth looks like, and at the same time we can see images from the tiniest crevices of our bodies, that we would have a more rational consensus on what's true and what isn't. And yet, of course, that's not the case. We are bombarded with ideas and with theories, and in a way, we sometimes seem to be more confused than ever.
James Gluck, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Gluck is the author of the bestseller Chaos. His new book, Genius, is a biography of the late physicist Richard Feynman. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, welcome back to All Things Considered after a few months of hosting Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's great to be back after about 3 months of being a talk show host.
Yeah, well, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing the news of the transition from Liz Arnold, who's down in Little Rock. We'll also be hearing about that Japanese plutonium and about the demonstrations, first in Germany over the weekend, against racism, a huge demonstration that was marred by an anarchist counter-protest. The anarchists in Berlin shouting, hypocrites, hypocrites, actually threw tomatoes and rocks at the president of Germany. And we'll also be having an introduction for beginners on how to cook a Thanksgiving dinner.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The recent death of a prominent translator provoked Fresh Air book critic John Leonard to think about where readers and writers would be without the translators of the world's great literature.
Ralph Manheim died last month at age 85, and nobody made a fuss, which is shameful. Though I never met him, there are parts of Manheim all over my house. From German and French into English, he was the heroic translator of novels by Günter Grass, Louis Ferdinand Céline, Peter Handke, and Hermann Hesse, of letters from Freud and from Proust, of mystifications by Martin Heidegger. Without the Manheims, the Gregory Rabassas, the William Weavers, and the Ivan Morrises, those of us who read for a living would be lots dumber than we are. Unless, like Edmund Wilson, we are intimate with six languages, or like James Joyce can spare the time to learn Norwegian to read Ibsen in the original, we must rely on what Manheim called impersonations. Standing on the shoulders of such translators, overworked, underpaid, and unsung, we glimpse the higher singing spheres. They love literature more than creature comforts. It's amazing, really, that Terence Kilmartin should have sought to improve on Scott Moncrief's Proust, or that Richard Peviar and Larissa Volkonsky took another crack at the Brothers Karamazov. And even the best translators are seldom in a position to choose their project. Long before his splendid work on the Tin Drum, Manheim had to translate Mein Kampf. Almost immediately after his magnificent job on 100 Years of Solitude, Rabassa got stuck with the banana plantation trilogy of the Guatemalan windbag Miguel Asturias. Not everything William Weaver translates from the Italian is as wonderful as Calvino, nor all that Ivan Morris renders from the Japanese as sinister as Mishima. Yes, something's lost in translation. there will always be a problematical messiness about the exchange from one culture to another of our deepest meanings, our coded identities. But the very complexity of literature exalts and complicates. We grow up on its scruple and witness. Unlike popular music, geopolitics, or the spider speak in green decimals of international currency speculation, novels make distinctions and connections. They teach us other ways to see. Through the gates of translators as gifted as Mannheim, we enter other magics. We are acquainted with the deepest chords in different musics, the darkest shadow in secret arts, the finest blood threads of unknown mother tongues. From such awareness, we levitate. This is the multiculture, a republic of dreams, and not only for readers and reviewers. The mature style of Garcia Marquez is unimaginable without the translations he read in his youth of Faulkner and Flaubert. Salman Rushdie, who speaks no Spanish, is unimaginable without Marquez, not to mention the Russian Bulgakov. Toni Morrison also grew up on Marquez. Gunter Grass has read Tanizaki and Carlos Fuentes. Kobo Abe was so blown away by the translation into Japanese of 100 Years of Solitude, he almost quit writing. Maxine Hong Kingston has rewritten most of the classic Chinese novels, from Dream of the Red Chamber to Journey to the West, featuring the very same Monkey King that so enthralls a Nobel laureate like Octavio Paz. And it's not just that these writers read each other in translation. Which translation they read is equally important. Garcia Marquez, for example, first read Kafka in a translation by Jorge Luis Borges. At some glorious point, what happens is more than translation. It is metamorphosis. About a whole generation of German-Jewish refugee intellectuals forced into exile by Hitler, Bernard Malamud observed, articulate as they were, the great loss was the loss of language, that they could not say what was in them to say. You have some subtle thought, and it comes out like a piece of broken bottle. Well, not while Ralph Mannheim was around. I'll miss him almost every time I think or dream.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's the 25th anniversary of Rolling Stone magazine. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with its founder, Jan Wenner. And we talk about record production with Mitchell Froom. He's produced albums by Los Lobos, Suzanne Vega, Elvis Costello, and Richard Thompson. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.